From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, exploring the many narratives about Detroit's history.
Once again, we see the ways in which the racial logics of place emerge to write a place that has over 650,000 people as empty, because indeed, it's primarily black.
The Lions stumbled into the playoffs as a wild card and missed their chance to win their first division championship in 23 years.
There are four teams in the division. So for 23 years, you should average around five or six of these things, and they just can't get it done.
How a library maker space can knit a community together.
We like that sense of self-expression. We like that sense of self-achievement that comes along with having created something ourselves.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside and Happy New Year. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, what is the new Detroit everyone keeps talking about? A new book illuminates issues of race and class and tackles key questions about the future of post-industrial America. That story later in the hour. But first, this is a new year. And even though the State House and Senate are adjourned until January 11th, it seems like a very good time to talk about what might be bubbling away on the front burner in Lansing this year. And for that, it's my pleasure to turn to Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta here with us.
Hi there.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We have so much to talk about. And just to get us all up to speed, give us a little refresher course, because some of us weren't paying a lot of attention at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. It was the holidays. What were the big bills that
and
got pushed through?
And
there was champagne involved. So what got pushed through?
What happened in Lansing?
There were a lot that the wolf hunting controversy was reignited, and the governor has signed a bill that would allow wolf hunting to take place in the Upper Peninsula should the gray wolf be taken off the federal endangered species lists. We saw a few other things go through
the
veterans' homes.
Energy
was by and far the biggest one. It resets Michigan's energy policy for really the next couple of decades. And yet, one thing that didn't get a lot of attention in this is this was really a moment where Rick Snyder kind of, you know, I mean, he performed. He became the governor that he really wanted to be, that we have a highly technical issue that has a lot of ins and outs, people with different senses of what direction it should take. It's very important to the future of the state, and especially infrastructure, which we will be talking about a lot. And he was able to bring everyone into the room, pull together a majority of votes on a very complicated package that most but not everyone generally agrees is pretty acceptable, unlike, say, you know, go back to the Rhodes package, which has been kind of universally reviled.
It sort of reminds me of what folks want government to do. Right. That whether or not you like the energy legislation, these energy bills, it's sort of what you hope. Right. The Democrats, Republicans come together and go, OK, we're going to take a little of this. We're going to give you a little of that.
Horse trade.
It's
political horse trade.
What he said at the beginning of his governorship that he would never do.
Going to work together.
But and so, you know, we really saw Rick Snyder become, I think, the governor that he really wants to be.
When here we want to think about priorities for Rick Snyder as he goes into the home stretch of his time in office. And for that, I mean, my goodness, we can't talk about that without talking about Flint water. I mean, you think about this coming April marks 3 years since that fateful moment when Flint's drinking water was switched from Detroit's to the Flint River. Mm-hmm. And I know you recently spoke with Governor Snyder, Rick, and Flint had to be on the agenda.
It was. And we asked about Flint and what was the impact that Flint had on, everything else. And here's what he had to say.
It probably took time away from potential new initiatives or ideas that I might have promoted that would be new things coming to the state. With respect to our current activities, I've got a great team. And so we've continued to work hard on many fronts, all during the worst part of the crisis.
So, you know, there he was, and you know, there he is, even in the face of the Flint water crisis, relentlessly positive. We were still getting it done. And I think, you know, the governor has tried, and Zoe, you can back me up on this, on a few different occasions in 2016 to kind of reset the conversation so it wasn't so exclusively focused on Flint, wouldn't you say?
Well, absolutely. And why wouldn't he? I mean, this was a huge disaster. It was a crisis of sort of epic proportions for the state. And this governor wants to focus on moving forward. This is someone who always says, I don't want to look backwards. I want to look forwards. And it's sort of like, well, that's fine. But you still have a city that can't drink its water.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, and his babies are talent development, mm-hmm. infrastructure, you know, wrapping up this bridge project in Detroit. Those are the things that capture his fancy. And going into 2017, we'll see him try to focus more, I think, particularly on infrastructure. But he cannot escape the shadow of Flint. That, you know, one of the things that we talked about in this interview is the fact that, you know, infrastructure is expensive. And we run into a situation where a lot of times, I know this happens a lot in Lansing, right on Michigan Avenue in view of the state capitol. It seems like that road is always being torn up mm-hmm. for some reason or another to deal with water or electric or in fact road repairs. And the governor says that this is a problem. And so his inner CPA has emerged again, and he wants to focus on what he's calling asset management.
But think about this. Think about the street or road in front of your home or in front of where you work. And think about as you go by all the time, and is that road torn up or not? And then you have to ask who tore it up and why. And quite often you'll find out they might have been tearing it up to do road repairs. Well, maybe a year later they came up and tore it up to make water and sewer repairs because it's underneath. And then they had new utility lines ruined, new gas lines or electric lines. So that got torn up. And then they wanted to run fiber. So it got torn up again. It's crazy to tear this road up four times over some time period. Let's coordinate all this. Let's do asset management, with the asset being this infrastructure. And how do we manage it so we can tear up the road once? And let's improve all four of those systems, if possible, at the same time, because that's a huge savings. How much money gets tied up in tearing up and repairing, you know, a road or other infrastructure to do other pieces of this? So let's do it once.
I think most people would say amen.
I think you're right. And think about in particular the impact of a policy like this mm-hmm. on a city like Flint, where every lead water line needs to be replaced. And how much money do you have to do that? And how much is going to get burned up doing that that could also be used on other things? You know, I mean, a modern telecommunications link up to every home and business in Flint would be a very important thing, I would think, for a city to have.
We're looking at the new year to come, 2017, and what we might expect as we talk to Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. You know, we stop here, and as we speak, it is 18 days until Donald Trump is sworn into office. And Governor Snyder has admitted Mr. Trump isn't returning his phone calls. And we know he didn't work to help Mr. Trump during the campaign.
No, in fact, he really kind of sat it out, didn't go to any events. While there were other Michiganders who went to quite a few of the rallies, I should say elected officials who went to the rallies and things like that. And Snyder really was a hands-off Republican when it came to that campaign. Although, let's also note, it's not like he was one of only a few. There were Republicans across the country
But a couple of businessmen who had never held elected office and run and win high office might have something in common.
But let's also not forget the number of times that Donald Trump came into the state of Michigan and said, look at this mess.
Although, you know, Mitt Romney did the exact same thing in 2012.
You know, he did not do it as fervently and forcefully as Donald Trump
did. Well, Mitt Romney didn't do anything as fervently or forcefully as Donald Trump did.
Most did not. What do you both think of President Donald Trump's going to mean for Governor Snyder and for Michigan?
Well, remember that Donald Trump famously made a trip to Flint and said that he was going to fix things there. Mm-hmm. And he went to Detroit and said more or less the same thing. And Donald Trump has said that he wants infrastructure to be a priority of his presidency. So in that respect, their interests, at least in the macro sense,
mm-hmm.
would seem to align. We'll see what happens when it gets down to the, you know, granular level and just what these projects are going to look like.
But I really think the biggest issue, and this is not just in Michigan for, you know, a Republican governor, but Republican governors of states and obviously Democrats who supported it, but that was Medicaid expansion. And here in Michigan, what's called Healthy Michigan. And You've got 600,000 new folks who were able to have health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And now, of course, as we know, Donald Trump's saying, you know, we want to repeal and replace. Republicans saying we want to repeal and replace. Mm-hmm. And what that will mean for these Michiganders who have, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Michiganders who have insurance. And Rick Snyder going, hey, you know, wait a second there, Donald Trump.
Worked pretty well here.
Well, and he worked very hard to get that adopted. Burned a lot of political capital. And the stakes are high enough that even Republican leaders in Congress have said that the Medicaid overhaul aspect of an Obamacare repeal and replace will not happen quickly because they understand what the effect would be on both the people who are covered and the healthcare providers. That, you know, hospitals are really, really concerned about this. That, you know, they've now built their business operations around the fact that they don't have to provide as much uncompensated care because of programs like Healthy Michigan. How is Congress going to deal with that? How is the new president going to deal with that?
We're going to have an interesting year. Can't let you go without just a couple of quick thoughts about priorities for the legislature. Mm-hmm. We're seeing new faces.
We've got a new Republican Speaker of the House coming in. Folks talked to him, and he sort of said a couple of the big things that are on his agenda. Teacher pension reform. That is one that came up last year. A really big deal. We will see that. Another one likely, auto no fault.
Local public employees, mm-hmm. you know, along
police
with the
fire.
Teachers.
Yeah.
Yep. Retiree health. Healthcare changes, and then also it'll be interesting to see if anything happens with FOIA expansion in the new legislative year or not. And we've got another Republican majority in both the state House and Senate, a Republican governor, so they will likely push conservative packages through. As we've seen.
More conservative than if Democrats were in control. But you know, the Republican coalition is not a monolith. We will see a new freshman class in the State House of Representatives that by and large is going to be more conservative, that's going to be tempered by the experience of the Michigan Senate. And so we'll see how those two things play out come 2017 and 2018 as we head into the campaign for the next governor and the future of the legislature.
Good way to end it. What an exciting year ahead. Our It's Just Politics team of Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. As always, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
You betcha.
Coming up, sports commentator John U. Bacon stops by.
Some Michigan fans are not happy unless they're not happy.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
Over the past few years, makerspaces have become more and more understood and popular. When you think of a makerspace, you could well imagine something like a shiny industrial warehouse with 3D printers, laser engravers, metalworking tools. But makerspaces can be different than that and more than that. Our latest contributors to The Next Idea have found a makerspace can become an important focal point for the whole community. Kristen Fonticciaro is here with us. She teaches at the University of Michigan School of Information, where she heads up a program called Making in Michigan Libraries. They help libraries around Michigan set up MAKE programs designed for the communities they serve. And one of the libraries that received a Making in Michigan Libraries grant is the Benzonia Library. Librarian Amanda McLaren is with us as well. Hello to both of you. And Kristen, let's get us on the same page. Just what is a makerspace?
Well, there's a lot of different meanings depending on who you ask. You're definitely right about the industrial makerspace in a large area that would have those high-tech, high-technology tools. But even in the city of Ann Arbor, in a place like MakerWorks, you'd also see welding tools and sewing machines and embroidery machines and machines to work with wood. And so I like to think that it's really a movement about creativity and making happen what you want to make happen. And really reconnecting with the world before smartphones and swiping everything, where we feel good creating things. We like that sense of self-expression. We like that sense of self-achievement that comes along with having created something ourselves.
Something I think that we've kind of lost.
I would say for sure in the middle class. I would not say so much in every economic class. We have some folks that still make out of necessity, and I think that's a really important point to make. Mm-hmm. But I think the ability for us to come together, use our hands, feel productive, whether it's with a high-end, high-tech tool or with a pair of knitting needles,
we want people to feel that sense of coming together, of being together, enjoying that interaction that comes when I see what you're making and it ups my ante just a little bit.
All right. So then taking it into this Making in Michigan Libraries program, was it a problem you were trying to address or was it something you were trying to give to communities? What was the goal?
Well, I'm a Michigan native and I love my state and I really have always loved the many types of communities we have in the state. In talking about possible funding ideas with our colleagues at the Institute of Museum and Library Services who fund this project, one of the things they noted was that professional development was reaching some areas of the state and not others, and they really encouraged us to look at parts of the state that were maybe underrepresented. And that helped us come up with an idea that we are very passionate about libraries. I love libraries. I am a tourist of libraries. But also that a library working on its own without its community just creates a siloed program. So we invited in educators and civic leaders and after-school program folks so that people could also see this work is happening in little bits and starts in your community already. You have handicraftsmen in your community already. How do you build on that together? There is no better place than Benzonia to watch how this is playing out.
Well, Amanda, what did you want to get out of the program when you decided to apply for a Making in Michigan Libraries grant?
I have to agree. I think it's all about community. And that was our main focus, to bring the community together, to get people to look at each other, to interact with each other. We have a very strong community in that people do pull together. But as far as bringing the kids in, just helping them find their passion, helping them find something that will really ignite a spark so that they feel driven to do something and to really participate in something.
Certainly, the more people coming into the library, the better for the library. I mean, it's got to be sometimes a challenge to stay relevant, especially, as you say, to the kids, the way perhaps the library was relevant to me as a baby boomer.
To some extent, but we're also in an area where internet doesn't reach everybody. And, you know, the library is more of a necessity here than it is in a lot of places. But I like to think they're here because they want to be as well.
Well, and the more things you can offer, then that works. And just so we're all clear, are you bringing in money? Are you bringing in training? When a grant is given, what's a library getting?
It isn't a formal subgrant program, but we started by looking for 8 places that could host multi-day professional development. Not just fly in and fly out, you get your 2 hours and you leave, but where do we come and we really settle and recognize that the hidden component in makerspaces that's always underestimated is the people. And we often had cases in the summertime where we were in Alpena. One person said, well, you know, there's a marine lab that does underwater remote-operated vehicle stuff with kids. And the woman a couple seats down said, yes, I run that program. So here was something that the community was proud of, but they hadn't ever met before. Mm. And so thinking about how does the power of the university come in and create some excitement, sort of in the Stone Soup way, that I hope that what we do is help communities to come together to make the decisions that they may not realize are right under their noses. Benzonia already knew it was right under their noses.
So, Amanda, tell us what kind of maker programs that you've been able to offer.
Some of the things that we were already doing here at the library before they came in, we have this group of amazing supporters, volunteers, and in particular, 2 of my staff members that double as volunteers as well. They are the repurposeful librarians. What they do, they take and repurpose materials and make crafts. For example, they made these lamps out of old books and, you know, Mod Podge the lampshades. Just beautiful, looks incredible. They take all these items that they make and they sell them at local craft fairs and then take all the money that they make from those items and put them into a crafting program here at the library, which is just a tremendous asset. I mean, there's so much that we couldn't do without what they are putting into the library here. And so we're very grateful about that. They take classes and learn what they can and then bring it here and teach it to our patrons for free.
It's very, very clear that as I hear Amanda talk about all these programs, this is really a nimble concept because every library and every community will have its own set of wants, needs, priorities. And so what you've come up with lets them do it. But then now here's the next question. How do we grow these kinds of programs?
For me, and our philosophy as a program has really been, you look to your community for what your community needs, and you start there.
And what I'm really interested in is not the fad of making, but the sustainability. I grew up in a household where we made stuff out of junk all the time. It was very rare to go to the craft store or the fabric store and get special supplies for things. But there were always scrap fabrics and pieces of wood. And there were supplies in the pantry for baking and cooking. And each of the children in our family still practices those, whatever sort of niche we had today. And I remember those feelings of sort of creating your world and your own agency. And when a library does what Amanda's library is doing and looks at, we're a small budget, where do we make the biggest impact? What is our community asking for? I mean, Amanda's had so many meetings with her new superintendent about how do we support what's happening in the school. Where I think it will be a fad will be, here's the checklist of what other people have. That's what we should have. And oftentimes starting with children and starting with the sense that they have a natural sense of discovery then helps us move into how do families engage with libraries? How do we make opportunities for adults to be as invested? So I'm thinking we had a MakerFest evening when we were in Benzonia, and there were so many grandparents who came with grandchildren, and they were so safe in the space that they sort of dispersed as a family into what they were most interested in. And I remember chiding a grandfather. In all the other cities, the adults hung back and let kids do things. So I jokingly say to this grandfather, oh, now when are you going to make something? And he says, I've already made 3 etched glasses over on that other table. Ah. And I think that that is a real strength of looking at how smaller communities come together because some of those separations aren't in place. So really thinking about what is echoing in our community, what is resonating in our community, starting small and seeing it as a multi-year process. There are a lot of folks, I mean, you mentioned 3D printers, and that's always the big inside joke with makerspaces is that everybody has one because everybody's expected to have one, but they're usually broken. And I remember when we were in Benzonia, we were one step away from ours being broken. It's like the party trick, but ultimately it's got some limitations from how broad the participation can be, how wide-ranging the participation can be. What are the things that draw communities together and empower them to take the next step? That's the real question.
Well, I won't let you go, Amanda, without telling us about the Power Tools for Women program. I looked on your website, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was a very exciting program. They brought in one of the employees from our local hardware store who was just wonderful, and he talked about power tool safety and best practices with power tools. And then all the women that were there went ahead and made the lamps out of the books. And that was a really exciting class. And we actually had to offer that one twice because it was so popular. And things like that, that just, where do you go to learn about power tool basics? If you don't have someone at home teaching you, how do you learn?
So you go to a makerspace.
You do. So that was very exciting. And I do want to talk about the Harry Potter satellite class that we had, because that was just another fantastic opportunity to let the imagination run wild. And so there was a class offered where you can come in and create the elixir of life and the recipe for a rejuvenation tonic. And these are all, everything that was used is stuff that you would find in your kitchen, just with the fun spin, you know, the frog spawn and, you know, stuff like that. But to see the looks on the kids' faces as they participated in that, because so many of these kids have read the Harry Potter books and have loved them, and they each received a wand when they arrived, and they received their OWL certificate when they left. And it was just an amazing moment for so many of these kids. And it was just so fun. And everything is like that. There has not been a time that we haven't offered a program for the kids that they have not walked out of here just excited to be doing something new and different and to have opportunities. And we're just so thankful to be able to offer that.
Amanda McLaren, librarian at the Benzonia Library, and Kristen Fonticciaro, University of Michigan School of Information. Thanks to both of you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time to say hello and Happy New Year to Michigan radio sports commentator John Eubank, and a lot for us to break down in our first get-together of 2017.
A whole lot, and Happy New Year to you.
Indeed. Maybe not such a Happy New Year or a so-so New Year for the Lions. I mean, we know they're headed for the playoffs for the second time in 3 years, but that 31-24 loss to Green Bay, it kind of feels like Detroit isn't marching into the postseason. It's kind of falling in backwards.
I believe Representative John Dingell tweeted, and I quote, "Lions gonna Lions," and that's just what the Lions did. Look, 2016 was a good year for the Lions. Matt Stafford made gigantic strides. He is the story of this team, no question about it. Jim Bob Cooter,
yes,
we've talked about him. Congratulations. But they are 9-7. They have not won the division for the a millionth time since 1993. There are four teams in the division. So for 23 years, you should average around five or six of these things. And they just can't get it done.
And I noticed someone tweeted last night, if Lions lose tonight, they finish 0-5 against playoff teams and 9-2 against non-playoff teams. Playoffs are populated by playoff teams.
It turns out that's exactly what happens in the playoffs. So
yes.
I mean, look, they got a long way to go. If I'm Matt Stafford, I'm very happy with my season. I know I'm going to be back. He looks like now a top five or six quarterback, and he's been tough as nails down the stretch with a screwed up middle finger on his throwing hand. The guy's been very good. If I'm Jim Caldwell, the head coach, I am less sanguine about my opportunities next year. He might get the axe.
Because making the playoffs was just because we saw a loss elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean,
they backed in, thanks to the
New York Giants. And this is a guy, by the way, you recall, Brady Hoke, Michigan's coach, very nice guy, very decent man, but he would not wear a headset. If you don't wear a headset, how do you know what's going on? Now, Caldwell wears a headset, but you almost never can see him speaking to anybody. The team is run by other guys. So at some point, you have to look at the guy at the helm and say, what exactly are you doing to right this ship? And it's not clear.
This is the seventh time the Lions have made the playoffs as a wild card since the last time they won the division, and it's a sorry record, 0-6 in those playoff games. Is this squad good enough to get past Saturday night against Seattle?
No. Next topic. Seattle is very good. Okay, that's the problem. They're coached by Pete Carroll, who has won Super Bowls, who knows what he's doing. He's won national titles at USC. This guy is a bona fide top five coach nationwide in the Harbaugh class.
How do you see the battle of the quarterbacks shaping up?
It'll be a good battle. Russell Wilson, of course, of Seattle, is a very serious quarterback. He can also run, which is not Stafford's thing, of course. Look, they've got a chance. I can't say they don't, but I don't give them a very good one.
You could kind of see it on the faces of the fans as the game went on. Everybody was really happy in the first half, but there were no adjustments made.
And that is called coaching. Because what a coach does, yes, you prepare your team, you got a game plan, but the real great coaches, the true greats, halftime is not a rah-rah time, contrary to the Gipper speeches and all the rest. It is X's and O's, what's working, what isn't. And as Bo said, you might have all the theories in the world. The first casualty of war is the war plan, right? At the end of the first half, you have data. Now, Detroit was up 14-10 at that point, but they could do very little right in the second half. And look, you're going against Aaron Rodgers, who is a bona fide elite quarterback.
Guys on fire. I want to get your thoughts on Michigan's Orange Bowl loss to Florida State. Were you surprised by that?
A little surprised, not dramatically surprised. I thought it was going to be a dogfight, but I thought Michigan was going to win it because Wilton Spade is in much better shape, the quarterback, than he was against Ohio State, where they also almost won. The running game is not going very, very far. They're going against a very good defense at Florida State. And as I said in August on your show, of course, I said this team's going to go 11-2. They're going to lose two out of the three road games, Michigan State, Iowa, Ohio State. They lost the last two. I thought they were going to win their bowl game, but I said the reason is the problem is the O-line is now only average. And against a superior defense, they could not get much done. The play calling was not great either.
So when you think about the season, Wolverines did not win the Big Ten championship. They didn't make the college football playoffs. They lost in the Orange Bowl. Would this be considered a successful season for Michigan?
Depends on which Michigan fans you ask, Cindy. My favorite self-quote, if you will, is some Michigan fans are not happy unless they're not happy.
You've said that a lot.
I said that a lot, and it sure does apply this week. Now, I've given you the bad news about the O-line and all that. Here's the good news. This team is 10-3. They won 10 games first 2 years. The last coach to do that at Michigan was Fielding Yost in 1901 and 02, people. That's more than a century ago. There have been some Hall of Fame coaches in between. So what the job they've done is phenomenal. It's absolutely 100% phenomenal in development and play. They're three plays away from being undefeated. That's how close this team was, and they're recruiting the lights out. So anybody who complains about the season, that's Michigan being Michigan, I guess.
And then what about next season? Because that's going to be kind of the Harbaugh recruits coming in.
Exactly right. Now, look, you're losing a lot of talent off this team. Yeah. Jake Butt, Jabril Peppers is almost certainly going to leave. You're losing a lot of good players. People are worried about that, and I get that. But they recruit so well, and they develop so well. This team is going to reload, not rebuild.
Well, we've seen Michigan, Central, and Eastern all lose their bowl games. Western Michigan's taking its 13-0 record up against Wisconsin today in the Cotton Bowl. So Mac against the Big Ten. David and Goliath?
A little bit of that, but look, David's had a hell of a year. I can point to a few Goliaths that have already gone down in David's past, so I would not count the Broncos out of this. Of course, Wisconsin's now fighting for the Big Ten's honor, which is after Ohio State got shellacked 31-0 against Clemson. Big Ten has had a very bad week.
Well, we'll make a date to talk about the Broncos next Monday, and it was delightful to have our new year start with your lovely little Teddy joining us here in the studio.
That's his first radio appearance, a small, quiet coos in the back. That's my boy making his radio debut.
We love seeing him. Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Eubagen. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy, and thank you, Peg Watson, for taking my kid.
Up next, Detroit's narrative from land of opportunity to beautiful wasteland. A new book explores the city's history and future. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How do we talk about Detroit? In the 80s and 90s, the focus was on crime and urban decay. Detroit is the murder city. Today, the narrative is one of possibility and resurgence. But both of these depictions are largely imposed by outsiders and are, at best, incomplete. Rebecca Kinney explores the narratives of Detroit's history in her new book, Beautiful Wasteland: The Rise of Detroit as America's Post-Industrial Frontier. Rebecca Kinney teaches in the School of Cultural and Critical Studies and the Department of Popular Culture at Bowling Green State University. And she grew up in Metro Detroit. Rebecca, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
What were you seeing or hearing that got you wanting to explore this question of the rise of Detroit as America's post-industrial frontier in this book?
Yeah. So I, you know, as you mentioned, I grew up in Metro Detroit and I spent about a decade living in California, first in Northern California and Southern California, working and then going to graduate school. And during that decade, living outside of Michigan, whenever people would find out, you know, I was from Detroit, there was always this moment of pause. And then there was always a follow-up question, you know, wow, you know, you're Asian. I didn't realize there were Asians in Detroit. Other questions would be, you know, wow, what's it like to live there? How'd you get out alive? And so I would always follow up and say, oh, well, tell me about, you know, when you were last in Detroit, or, you know, tell me how you know about the city. And more often than not, people would always say, oh, well, I've never been there. You know, these are just things that I heard or that I know. And long about maybe the early 2010s, people would start to follow up instead of with those questions that I was used to and expecting and having, you know, my answers ready to go, would really follow up with these questions of, or statements of, I hear there's really interesting things happening in Detroit, or I heard Detroit is such, you know, a place on the rise. And again, I would always ask, how do you, you know, come to know these stories? Tell me about the last time you were in Detroit. And again, most of the people saying this to me would often remark that they had never been to Detroit.
So you realize there were a lot of things shaping people's view of Detroit that had nothing to do with anybody setting foot in the city.
Right. Exactly. And so that's really where kind of the motivation for the book comes from, is really about how are the narratives told about Detroit by both former Detroiters as well as people around the nation and the world. How do they stand in for the narratives that are known about this city? And so in many ways, although I'm a Metro Detroiter, I don't necessarily claim myself as a Detroiter. And I think that that's an important perspective and note, that my motivation and really standpoint in writing the book is really to think about how Detroit is framed from an outside perspective.
But you're a good one to do it because you've grown up here. You know it. So it isn't like so many stories that have been done where people come in. I know Time Magazine set up that house in Detroit and we're going to embed people like as if it's in a combat zone in Iraq. But yeah, so you've got a sense of how outsiders view Detroit and the Detroit area.
Right.
And you've grown up here.
Right. And I think that it's a really important kind of tension in line because as a Metro Detroiter, I realize that Detroit and the metropolitan area has been willfully divided for so many decades. Mm-hmm. And really thinking about the importance of, you know, highlighting that division in both the history of Detroit's rise, fall, narrative, as well as highlighting that division in the narrative of the return and the rise of Detroit. Yeah. Because I think that that's an important piece that is missed, particularly as so many Metro Detroiters are now re-embracing the city in the 21st century. I think that it's this important moment of, you know, kind of pushing back against this re-embrace without questioning what factors led to and contributed to the decline of the city.
In Beautiful Wasteland, Rebecca, you explore all these different narratives of Detroit through the 20th and the 21st century using advertising and ruin photography, which many call ruin porn, mm-hmm. or print, film, media, conversation threads you found online, all kinds of sources. Can you give us a sense of the story arc that you found for Detroit, starting, let's say, in the 1980s, early 90s, and taking us up to today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the story arc is something that I like to refer to as the standard narrative of Detroit. Really, you have to go back a little bit further, I would argue, to the 20s and 30s, right, to the narrative of Henry Ford's $5 day, which people, again, kind of take that as a standard narrative without looking at that back research that realizes that $5 day was profit sharing, required you to meet certain class citizenship standards, behavior and comportment standards. So it wasn't just this easy kind of,
hey, everybody, come on in.
Exactly. So yes. I think that the standard narrative really goes back to kind of the early 20th century, wherein there's a narrative that work was available for anybody who wanted work. And it really kind of elides the divisions between race, gender, class and citizenship that mediated access to work even then. But the standard narrative, you know, really suggests that if you came to Detroit, particularly in the mid-20th century, you could find a job on the line without a high school education. That job would afford you the ability to buy a home, to send your children to good schools.
Maybe get a cottage up north.
Exactly. Like, so really to live that American dream. And while that narrative bore out to be true for many, many Detroiters, and I don't want to, you know, disregard that or take mm-hmm. that away. It wasn't a narrative that was available to all Detroiters. And so that's the standard narrative of rise. And then the standard narrative of fall really pivots typically around the 1967 rebellion, although as the book aims to show that 1967 was not a catalytic moment. It was actually kind of a moment in which what had already existed in terms of decentralization of industry in terms of suburbanization was simply amplified, but was not the moment at which this massive change happened. And so right around that moment, though, there is a national narrative of Detroit's decline or fall.
The white flight.
The white flight.
Yes.
I mean, I think that population bears that out mm-hmm. and statistics bear it out. And what I'm really interested in is the ways in which the narrative of Detroit's rise is seen as and written as and conceptualized as a race-neutral project, so that it's not actually about race, it's not actually about white privilege, for example, but indeed it's about this universal access to Detroit's rise. And when the narrative of Detroit's fall emerges, as I write about in chapter one of the book in particular, it's always narrated as this influx of black population primarily mm-hmm. and the decline of white population. And so what I'm aiming to do is to really question how that narrative makes white privilege invisible. And so how does this narrative of white flight then create this narrative of black city that is in decline, rather than looking at the other side of white flight, for example, which is indeed the white suburbanization and the subsidization of property ownership in the suburban periphery. And so I think that that's an important piece.
And sucking life out of the city, in a sense.
Right, in terms of taxes, in terms of spending dollars.
But then that sets up, so here we are where things are looking more optimistic as Detroit has gotten its way through this historic bankruptcy,
right.
Gotten through it in pretty record time.
Right.
And now we're back to, and even the words to use, is it the resurrection of Detroit? Is it the reshaping? Is it the, you know, what is it? And that is really very much depending on who you're talking to.
Right. And I think that it's this important moment and what the book, you know, really hopes to show or asks us to pause and think about is that there even still, even in this moment leading up to the bankruptcy, there was over 650,000 people living in Detroit, well up and through, you know, I think that's the 2010 census number. Mm-hmm. And even still, there was this narrative that the Detroit is empty or depopulated or this space that's completely open for development, you know, this new frontier for people to move to, you know, pin their hopes and dreams on. And I think that once again, we see the ways in which the racial logics of place emerge to write a place that has over 650,000 people as empty because, indeed, it's primarily Black. And so the ways in which the invisibility of whiteness emerges again and again in the story of Detroit, particularly in its late 20th century and early 21st century narrative, is a central piece of focus for the book.
I'm talking with Rebecca Kinney. Her book, Beautiful Wasteland, The Rise of Detroit as America's Post-Industrial Frontier, looking at, as you say, these story arcs about Detroit, what they're missing. When we talk about this comeback of Detroit, what would be a more accurate storyline, do you think?
I mean, I think that, you know, the way I close out the book thinking about how so much of Detroit's rebirth, quote unquote, and rise is written within the 7.2 square mile greater downtown area. So the area that's been deemed kind of this focus of redevelopment by a nonprofit consortia of groups. Mm-hmm. is really only 5% of Detroit's story. And so to focus on only what's happening in, you know, this tight, finite area of Corktown, of Midtown, of Downtown, of the riverfront, leaves out all of the other stories of Detroiters who have long existed within those neighborhoods and then also the 95% of the city outside of that area.
When you think about that area, you mm-hmm. touch on this, you know, after you've researched and written this book, I'm wondering what thoughts you came away with about those big name developers who are spending big money, mainly in downtown Detroit, but, you know, the Illich family, certainly Dan Gilbert. So here you have Dan Gilbert, who's bought more than $1 billion in office, retail, and residential property downtown. And you see some who hail him as a major driver in getting downtown Detroit pumped up again and kicking, because there were some pretty long and bleak years. Mm-hmm. You have others who think he's not doing anything to help the residents of Detroit, only to enrich his bottom line. Mm-hmm. What do you think, after all of the research you've done, about these views?
I think that, you know, from my perspective, Dan Gilbert is most invested in Dan Gilbert and most invested in creating a quote unquote thriving downtown playscape for, you know, his workers, for tourists, for the people he's trying to attract to the city so that ultimately his real estate investments will pay off in the end. I do think that he has bought, and this is even an outdated number, so mm-hmm. as of this past summer, I'm sure that there's been more, within 5 years, it was $1.2 billion mm-hmm. worth of property. That amount of investment in such a concentrated, finite area is bound to change a city in such a dramatic fashion and so quickly. And I think that, you know, any of us who are familiar with the city for longer than 5 years or 10 years, just the pure amount of building change and the changes in the physical landscape are undeniable, but also the changes in terms of the either you're with us or against us kind of narrative of Detroit's development. So if we think back to this past November's election and the defeat of Prop A, so much of the rhetoric around the anti-Prop A folks was that if we vote for this, right, or if you vote for this.
The community benefits.
The community benefits, A and B.
Yeah.
A and B. And A had a lower threshold by which a developer would need to then give back to community.
And engage with a community group, right. Neighborhood group, yes.
And it failed. And part of the reason it failed, I think, was because of the huge campaign around it mm-hmm. To ensure that it would fail, which basically, you know, so many people boil down to that if this passes, then nobody will develop it in Detroit mm-hmm. again and, you know, will be the Detroit of 10 years ago. And so to me, that is both kind of a scare tactic. And then also it gives me pause to consider what is that Detroit of 10 years ago that, you know, that the people who are purporting this are so afraid of? Because I think that for me, I will never forget that in 2014, when the first Detroit Homecoming Conference was held, bringing back mm-hmm. Detroit expats yep. from so, around the country
and around
the world.
Get back down to Detroit and
right.
share and talk.
Right. And they recently just had their third Homecoming Conference. But in the Detroit Homecoming one, wherein Dan Gilbert interviewed Warren Buffett on stage, mm-hmm. right, the billion-dollar stage, I will never forget that it was quoted that Warren Buffett said that, you know, now is the time to invest in Detroit. If we look back to New York of the 1970s, nobody could have ever imagined that New York of the 1970s would become the New York of today. So to me, when somebody like Warren Buffett really suggests that the potential that Detroit of the 2010s is going to be the New York of the 1970s gives me great pause, because the New York of today is unaffordable and out of reach, not just for working people and poor people, but for middle class people. The New York of today is ruled by financial elites from around the world as opposed to a local body. I do think that, you know, in Detroit, the ways in which the massive amounts of development of Dan Gilbert and Bedrock Industries happened simultaneous to the state takeover and installment of an emergency financial manager and then the subsequent bankruptcy of the city cannot be underplayed in terms of the significance of those moments together. Because as the city itself lost so much of its power for self-governance during that moment of emergency financial management, and even still is rather weakened by that plan through bankruptcy, you had a private investor, Dan Gilbert, rising as a huge voice in how the future of Detroit would be built, would be paid for, would be imagined. And, you know, unlike a mayor or a city council member, Dan Gilbert can't be unelected. Dan Gilbert, you know, has no constituency beyond his stakeholders, beyond the people who invest in his companies.
Is it a bad thing to see buildings being refurbished, getting revived, getting new life, and then being used, buildings that had been decaying and empty for years and years and years are suddenly happening with residential or retail? Is that a bad thing?
No, I do not think that development, you know, is a bad thing. And I want that to be clear. But I do think that the scale in which the development is happening, the ways in which so much public subsidy of these developments is happening. So, for example,
the Red Wings, the Little Caesars Arena.
Yeah. And then the conversation now about the Pistons owner and, you know, he'll move the Pistons downtown if there's a $34.5 million tax subsidy. So the ways in which these big time investors rely on public subsidy, that is why it's not just investment. Second to that, if you look at something like the M1 Detroit streetcar line, or, you know, now it's known as the Q line, if you look at that, it's, again, primarily funded by private investors. It does receive a little bit of public subsidy. But importantly, it took over, I mean, Woodward Avenue for about 2 years, right? It took up, I mean, we all sat in that traffic, you know, went around the traffic cones. I mean, it took up public space, and it will continue to take up public space in a public street for the ongoing future. And so I think that those are the questions that when the public is subsidizing an investment that has the potential to benefit only a very few of the public in a city the size and scale of Detroit, that's when it gives me pause.
You pose this question in your book, Rebecca, why is Detroit such a compelling story? So I want to put that question to you. Why do you think Detroit has this ability to capture the national imagination?
You know, I think it's and I do think that part of what I do in the book is really seek to answer why Detroit, why now? And I think that so much of this compelling part of Detroit in the 20-teens is deeply related to the recession, the national and the global recession of 2008. Because I think that the resurgence of Ford and GM post-auto bailout became national and international headlines in what could be, you know, argued was such a deeply depressing kind of moment for the country economically, that there became this narrative that if Detroit can make a comeback, then anywhere can make a comeback. And so in this way, Detroit, again, was able to stand in for a place that had really, you know, reached the bottom of the barrel, but yet was still thriving and still surviving.
Well, as your book puts it, the upcycled version of the American dream. Mm-hmm. Beautiful Wasteland, The Rise of Detroit as America's Post-Industrial Frontier, written by my guest, Rebecca J. Kinney. Great to talk with you, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And
Ann.
That's our show for today. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Josh Hakala. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.